My name is Mark Schwain, and I'm currently the village philosopher. And when I'm not philosophizing at the village, I'm teaching in Chicago, and there I teach American studies and humanities. What I'd like to do for the next hour or so is to simply go over the historical background to the decision to drop the atomic bombs on August 6th and then again one on August 9th on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I don't know how many of you were at the forum last night, but at that time I made a kind of opening statement to open up the issue of the relationship between Christianity and military service. And in passing suggested that one of the considerations in my mind, which was very much struggling with those questions, when I put my historian's hat on, turned upon this very event, that is, the decision to use atomic weapons. And I suggested very briefly, and then in response to a question, suggested that I would pursue the question this afternoon rather than last night. I suggested very briefly that the decision to use atomic weapons was much more complicated and, to me, much more tragic and worrisome than the reason that's most often given, and I think by most Americans most understood, as explaining the painful and reluctant choice to deploy these terrifying weapons of destruction to end the Second World War. A gentleman asked me at that time, wasn't it easy for me to say that now with 20/20 hindsight? And I suggested that the answer to that would take some time, and that's one of the issues that I want to address this afternoon. Before I begin, I should caution you that any historical interpretation of a sequence of events is just that, an interpretation. There's no way I can give you all the facts, and so I've made some selections, but I've tried to arrange the presentation in a careful chronological sequence, and I've tried to use as many primary documents, that is, documents that were written at the time, state papers, private diaries, and so on, of our statesmen and military advisors, so that as I unfold these events and read these texts, in a way you'll be in a position to begin to construct your own interpretations of why it was we dropped these bombs. I've drawn a timeline on the board, which I'm sure is inscrutable to most of you, particularly if you're sitting in back, because I think that it's important to keep a sequence of events straight. What I have done is to simply draw in a timeline beginning in April of 1945 and extending to November 1st of 1945. Each one of these major segments represents 1 month in time. And I will go through these events as the presentation unfolds. Before going into the actual narrative, I want to share a reflection with you that was really first made about democracies, and particularly about democracy in America, by a foreign observer in the 19th century who was one of the shrewdest, I think, students of American political culture that we've had. His name was Alexis de Tocqueville. He was a Frenchman. And in speaking of American democracy, he made this very interesting observation. He said that democracies, and in particular American democracy, may be among the slowest countries to actually go to war, that is, very reluctant to enter into warfare. But once in war, they become the most difficult of all political systems to cease fighting. That is, they're reluctant to enter, but precisely because entry requires such a massive public consensus, in order for the war to work, and in order for the participation of democracy in war to be effective. Precisely for that reason, it's very hard to put any restraints on the behavior of democracies in warfare. I think that's an interesting observation, and as I unfold the narrative, one of the things you might ask yourselves is whether or not this sequence bears that observation out. The story, it seems to me, really begins with a tragedy, that is the unexpected and sudden death of Franklin Delano Roosevelt on April 12th of 1945. It was then that Harry S. Truman, who many people called that little man from Missouri, found himself not simply president of the United States. That's difficult and ominous enough. As my friend the other evening, who served in the Congress for 8 years, said, we may have made the presidency simply an impossible task. But Harry Truman faced not simply the presidency, but the presidency in one of the critical periods in world history, really. Because World War II was fast ending and all sorts of major decisions had to quickly be made. One major decision that had quickly to be made involved information which had been of such top secret a nature that the Vice President of the United States, until April 12th, President Truman, who then became President Truman, was utterly unaware of it. Because 2 weeks after he became president, he was briefed by the Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, about what was then codenamed the Manhattan Project. It was then on April 26th that Truman was first given a full briefing on what had been perhaps the most expensive, the largest scale, and the best kept secret in world history. That is to say, a program that by 1944 had begun to spend money at approximately the rate of $1 billion a year to develop nuclear weapons. That program, codenamed the Manhattan Project, had come about as a result, and here I'll be somewhat brief, of the following sequence of events. As early as 1938, late in 38 and early in 1939, two physicists, one named Leo Szilard, who was Hungarian, and the other Albert Einstein, German, approached, but now living in America, approached Franklin Roosevelt and told him that the Germans were working on experiments in physics that could well lead to the splitting of the atom, which in turn could well lead to their developing, Nazi Germany developing, weapons of tremendous destructive force. Roosevelt immediately appointed an advisory committee, and a number of scientists in different universities began working on physical research around the splitting of the atom, possibly with the ultimate aim of developing such weapons ourselves, first conceived as defensive deterrence against Germany. In 1941, of course, the United States entered World War II, and by 1942, the president authorized this massive Manhattan Project, which consisted of scores of scientists, many engineers, and a huge number of processing plants that were to develop the nuclear materials to be used in what would ultimately become the atomic bombs. This started now in May of 1942, so that by the time Truman learns of it in 1945, it's already been going on for approximately 3 years and has already spent something like $2.5 billion. So Stimson briefs Truman on the progress of the research and development. It's pretty far along then, but most scientists are very pessimistic about being able to develop nuclear weapons for use if that should become necessary in the Second World War. Sure enough, a couple of weeks after Truman is briefed, the war against Germany ends. May 8, 1945 is what is sometimes known as VG Day, Victory Over Germany Day, and Germany indeed surrenders. The war in Europe is over, so that the original impelling cause for developing atomic weapons has now disappeared. Nazi Germany is completely vanquished. There remain now a number of very urgent problems. And the most urgent problem is now to conclude all of the sort of post-war against Germany, negotiations about territorial settlements, the fate of Germany as a country, the division of the city of Berlin, the governments of a number of Eastern European countries, because basically the alliance between the United States and the Soviet Union and Britain had begun already to show severe signs of strain and mistrust long before this timeline begins. As early as 43 and 44, there are severe signs of strain and mistrust. And so President Truman looks forward to attending what I have locked in here as the Potsdam Conference, which is held in a small city outside of Berlin and goes on from July 17th through August 2nd. Now this conference, as I say, involves a meeting between Stalin, Churchill, and Roosevelt, although there's a change of British government during the conference, and so Churchill has an untimely departure. But nonetheless, those are the three major figures there, though other governments are also represented to debate these diplomatic issues. Truman, during June, is preparing for that conference, setting the groundwork for it. And in the meantime, the American military is able to turn its full attention to the war in the Pacific. Now I'd like to begin to read to you from some of the goings-on in the month of July. President Truman leaves for Potsdam on July 7th, and he's on board ship. It takes him approximately a week to reach Germany. Doesn't take a whole week on board ship, but he arrives in Antwerp and then takes the automobile, and he arrives on the 15th of July. But at any rate, he's on board ship when a very interesting thing happens on the 12th of July. What happens is that the Japanese contact, through their foreign minister, their Russian counterparts in Moscow. Russia at this point has not declared war against Japan and is certainly not fighting the Japanese. And so the Japanese use the good offices of Moscow sometimes to send major signals of their intentions regarding the conclusion of hostilities with the United States. On July 12th, then, the following cable arrives in Moscow. I'll read excerpts from that cable for you. Tojo, Japan's foreign minister, sent a radio message to Ambassador Naotaki Sato in Moscow. Quote, "His Majesty is extremely anxious to terminate the war as soon as possible, being deeply concerned that any further continuation of hostilities will only aggravate the untold miseries of the millions upon millions of innocent men and women in the countries at war. Should, however, the United States and Great Britain insist on unconditional surrender, Japan would be forced to fight to the bitter end." That's the cable. What complicates this story is that by this time the United States intelligence has not only intercepted all the messages that passed between Tokyo and Moscow, but has broken the Japanese diplomatic code. So they immediately send this message, unbeknownst to the Japanese and unbeknownst to the Soviets, to President Truman. President Truman then becomes aware, while on board ship, steaming for the Potsdam Conference, that the Japanese have made an overture to the Russians about surrender, although unconditional surrender they won't abide. That is, they want to maintain the status of their emperor. On the 16th, in New Mexico, the test of the first atomic bomb is successfully completed at 5:30 a.m. Let me read you briefly some of the descriptions of that event from the scientist's point of view.
Mark, could you clarify one thing? You said $2 billion had been spent up to this point?
Yes.
You have, in the 35 intervening years, can you guess at an equivalent in dollars? for today. That seems like that must have been, that was an enormous amount of money.
True. I can't, maybe someone else here can easily translate those figures into $1980. I'm not sure. I would imagine it would be safely double that in 1980. At least double that.
It would be near 10 times that.
Really?
I think so. If you compare it to the cost of living,
mm-hmm.
the general cost of living in the... No, wait a minute. I'm sorry. I am too far off afield there. Probably 5 times that.
Okay, so we're talking about a figure somewhere around $10 billion in 1980 dollars expended on this project. Okay, so July 16th now, the test is completed, and successfully so. That is, the bomb does go off. Here's just one brief description. The intensity of light was such, this is Lansing Lamont, an observer of the experiment, the intensity of light was such that it could have been seen from another planet. The temperature at its center was 4 times that at the center of the sun, and more than 10,000 times that at the sun's surface. Many of the nuclear scientists had expected that the explosive force of that test bomb would be between 5,000 and 10,000 tons of TNT. It turned out to be more like 20,000 tons of TNT. Enrico Fermi, one of the early scientists who worked on the project, thought that it would burn the actual atmosphere and possibly destroy the entire state of New Mexico. It's fortunate that he was mistaken on that score. Fermi had been the scientist who, in 1942, incidentally, had achieved the first self-sustaining nuclear chain reaction beneath Stagg Field at the University of Chicago. I mentioned that because my office, my study, is now located some 50 feet above that site. And I feel somewhat trepidatious. Think of this at least once a week because of that, I suppose. So, all right, the atomic test succeeds. The test of the atomic bomb succeeds on July 16th, and immediately Truman is cabled of the success of that experiment. But something else is going on July 16th, because by this time the various delegations have arrived in Potsdam. Conference formally opens the next day, and there's now a meeting held between the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the United States and their counterparts in Britain. The prospect of using atomic weapons is one of the things on that agenda, and I'd like now for a moment to eavesdrop on that particular conference to hear what people were saying at that time. In Potsdam that morning, the American Joint Chiefs of Staff met to talk about the war in Japan. This is now the morning of the 16th. H.H. quote Hap Arnold, Chief of Staff of the Air Force, said that conventional bombing could end the war. He was probably basing this estimate on the fact that by March of 1945, the saturation firebombings of Tokyo had begun. Iwo Jima had fallen in February, and now American planes were flying night raids over Tokyo, and just the first night raid using napalm firebombs in March 9th and 10th, that evening, killed 80,000 people, destroyed 25% of the buildings in Tokyo, and made 1 million people homeless. This firebombing had increased in tempo and duration ever since March, and so basically Japan was being simply destroyed by firebombs. Thus, the Chief of Staff of the Air Force thinks that air power alone will soon eliminate the country. Next, General George C. Marshall thought that the Japanese should at least be forewarned so that they would have a chance to surrender before the bomb was used. Admiral E.J. King believed a naval blockade alone would end the war by starving the Japanese into submission. General Eisenhower told Secretary of War Stimson that Japan was already utterly defeated. It was, he said, and this is in Eisenhower's words, completely unnecessary to drop the bomb, and it would only rouse world opinion against the United States to use a horrible weapon that was, quote, no longer mandatory as a measure to save American lives. This is what Eisenhower and Marshall and King are saying on the same day that the bomb is successfully tested, July 16th. July 17th, the Potsdam Conference opens to discuss all of these diplomatic questions. On the morning of July 17th, having heard Eisenhower's statement, Secretary of War Stimson approaches the U.S. Secretary of State, who at that time is James Byrnes, B-Y-R-N-E-S. Stimson proposes two things: that on the basis of the intercepted cable, the one I told you about on July 12th, and on the basis of the military meeting, that the United States first offer Japan surrender terms which still permit them to have their own emperor, subject to whatever military command should occupy Japan until it was reconstituted, so that the surrender not be unconditional. And also that, number two, the Japanese should be given, as Marshall had suggested, strong warning about the fact of a nuclear bomb. Secretary of State Byrnes, speaking for President Truman, rejected both of these suggestions out of hand. Now you might say, well, now why would he reject these two suggestions out of hand? And the answer to that question begins to get us into what I suggested was the complexity of this decision. Because by this time, we're in the midst of a diplomatic conference involving diplomacy after the war against Germany. And tangled now within all of that is the military decision having to do with the war against Japan. These become kind of inextricably tangled up in policymakers' minds. They're not at all separate issues, as we'll see. You might say, well, why not offer, since we know by intercepting the cable, the Japanese surrender terms which permit them to keep their emperor and thus save face, or warn them about the bomb? What's wrong with those alternatives? Well, part of that answer comes from the diaries of Secretary of State Byrnes, and I now want to read you an excerpt from that. One of the problems here was always, when will Russia enter the war against Japan? Remember, the war against Germany had ended on the 8th. Russia hadn't even declared war on Japan, much less entered the war against Japan. Stalin promises on May 8th that he'll enter the war against Japan in 3 months. This time, for once, Stalin was quite literally true to his word. Because if you look at this time chart, you'll notice August 8th, in between the droppings of the two bombs, one on Hiroshima, one on Nagasaki, the Soviet Union declares war on Japan. Now, what's going on here at Potsdam is that the American policymakers are profoundly ambivalent about wanting Russia entering the war against Japan. Why? Because a lot of the diplomatic issues in Europe turn on the location of troops where the war ended. If you get out a map and look at where the Soviet troops wound up when they converged with the Allied troops in Germany, you get that picture in your mind and superimpose upon it then those countries that are in the what is called communist bloc and those countries that are in the non-communist bloc, those two geographical lines coincide pretty much. That is, what's in the mind of American policymakers is, if we can keep Russia out of the war, if the war can end before Russia enters it, that is the war against Japan, then what basis would Russia have for any territorial claims she might wish to make, or any political influence that she might wish to exert? Okay? So basically, there's this ambivalence, particularly in Secretary of State Byrnes, about the desirability of Russia to enter the war. In fact, on the next day, after the quote I just read you, he instructs Chiang Kai-shek to tie Stalin up in negotiations regarding the terms on which Russia would participate with the Chinese against Japan to sort of prolong the time at which the Soviet Union would be prepared to enter the war. And why do they want to do this? Well, I've already suggested the answer, but let me give it to you now out of Burns' own diaries. Stalin might immediately enter the war, that is, if he's not tied up with Chiang Kai-shek in negotiations, knowing full well, and here it becomes rather complex, that he could take not only what Roosevelt and Churchill, and subsequently Chiang Kai-shek, had agreed to at Yalta, but, with China divided, whatever else he wanted. On the other hand, if Stalin and Chiang were still negotiating while the war ended, it might delay Soviet entrance, and the Japanese might surrender before the Russians had a chance to enter the war. All right, so now you begin to see, I think, that the date, August 6th, looms rather large. Most of us, I think what President Truman then believed and had maintained ever since, that the reasons we dropped the bombs were that they saved millions of American lives and that they ended the war. Trouble with that argument, though I believe it, President Truman sincerely believed it, is that the earliest planned invasion of the Japanese mainland, and when you talk about millions of lives, you must be talking about a massive land invasion, was drawn up by the Joint Chiefs of Staff and approved May 25th and called for that invasion to take place November 1st. Now notice that November 1st is some 2.5 months after August 6th. August 6th, however, is 2 days before the 3 months after August 8th, after May 8th, which is the date that Stalin said he would enter the war against the Japanese. So you see now how diplomacy, military strategy are becoming inextricably tangled together. What else is going on July 23rd? July 23rd, we're still at Potsdam. July 23rd is the date of the diary entry I just read you from Secretary of State Burns' diary. Turns out that what else is going on July 23rd is that one of the nuclear scientists, the same scientist, Leo Szilard, who had joined Einstein in first warning Roosevelt back in the late 30s about the German scientists working on nuclear fission, circulates a petition among his fellow scientists who have begun to have deep moral qualms about the use of atomic weapons. I'd like now to read you the results of that petition of some 150 scientists, physicists who had been working for years now on the development of atomic weapons. 150 scientists now. In favor of using the bomb in any way to bring about Japanese surrender, 15%. In favor of a military demonstration, 46%. Military demonstration meaning under neutral auspices, taking the delegates from the Japanese government and military, demonstrating the weapon on some uninhabited atoll and pointing out what would happen if they didn't surrender. 46% of the scientists favor that. In favor of an experimental demonstration as a warning, 26%. In favor of a demonstration and no threatened use at all, 11%. In favor of no use, no demonstration, and continued secrecy, 2%. In short, 85% of the nuclear scientists polled suggested that, at most, the weapon be demonstrated, and only 15% thought that it ought to be used. That petition is finally sent up through General Groves, who is the head of the Manhattan Project, but it never arrives in Truman's hands prior to his signing of the order to use the atomic weapons, which happens 2 days later on July 25th. When the news of the successful test of the nuclear weapon reached Potsdam, and Truman immediately informed one of his allies, Churchill, but waited for some time, as we'll see, before informing Stalin, Churchill was jubilant. He was especially jubilant because he thought this would guarantee American supremacy in the post-war world, that the Russians would not have to say in the Pacific what they were saying about settlement in Europe. And one of his aides that evening, after seeing Churchill's jubilation, made the following diary entry. This is on the same day now, July 23rd, that I read you the Burns entry, and the same day that Szilard sends his petition. This This is a member of the British delegation named Lord Moran. And he's just seen Churchill's reaction to the successful test of the atomic weapon and to the American determination to use it against Japan. I own I was deeply shocked by this ruthless decision to use the bomb on Japan. I knew I was hopelessly illogical. From bows and arrows to bullets and shells and gas shells and gas to a torpedo which might send 1,000 men to the bottom of the sea, and finally to an atomic bomb. There could be no point when the process of destruction becomes immoral. It was all to no purpose. There had been no moment in the whole war when things looked to me so black and desperate and the future so hopeless. I knew enough of science to grasp that this was only the beginning, like the little bomb which fell outside my hut in the woods near some town in Europe in 1915. And made a hole in the ground the size of a wash basin. It was not so much the morality of the thing, it was simply that the linchpin that had been underpinning the world has become half wrenched out. I thought of my boys. Rowan came into the room and I found myself listening to his conversation with the Prime Minister as one hears the voices around when going under an anesthetic, voices very far off and not like real people. I went out and wandered through the empty rooms. I once slept in a house where there had been a murder. I felt like that here. Next day, July 24th, we're still at Potsdam. Finally, Truman decides that he will tell Stalin both about the successful test and also then about America's determination to use atomic weapons against the Japanese. I'd now like to read some descriptions of people who were at that encounter. The end of the negotiating session when Truman walks around and tells Stalin about this weapon.
Excuse me, Mark.
Yeah?
When you say America's determination, are you referring to the Secretary of State at that point?
I'm referring to Truman and the Secretary of State. Right. Burns and Truman, who have decided, and I'll tell you, the 25th is the next day when the decision is formally made. And Truman says that he simply never had any doubts about it, that he never thought about not using them. And basically the advice he was getting from Stimson and the military and so on, he claimed always that he viewed it as just another weapon, and that one, as a commander-in-chief, uses whatever weapons are necessary to end a war. So basically that was his and Burns' position. Burns always representing the view that it was a great diplomatic coup to use the weapons because it would keep the Russians out of the Japanese theater and it would make them, as Burns said, quote, much more manageable in Europe if they see, one, that the United States is willing to use a weapon of this destructive power, and two, are willing to use it when it's not militarily necessary. Because Burns thought that Stalin knew full well, given Stalin's own plans to enter the war by August 8th, that he knew that we knew that it wasn't militarily necessary because we could at least wait for his entry, because the Japanese might have capitulated with that alone. And the thought that Burns had was if he saw the America's will at that point, we'd basically be able to control European as well as Far Eastern politics for the next 15 years. But that was Burns' position. Truman never articulated that argument so much as the argument, it never occurred to me not to use it because of the saving American lives. That was always his position. Okay, now I want to read you this encounter between Stalin and Truman when Truman walks around the table. And this is from a number of reminiscences and diaries. Truman walks around, addresses Stalin. I was perhaps 5 yards away, Churchill remembered, and I watched with the closest attention the momentous talk. I knew what the president was going to do. What was vital to measure was its effect on Stalin. I can see it all as if it were yesterday. Secretary of State Burns, too, was watching. At the close of the meeting, the president walked around the circular table to talk to Stalin. Leahy, who was the closest military advisor to Truman, Admiral Leahy, Leahy tried not to appear to be watching the conversation, but did, and reported that it was it struck him as being astonishingly casual. Now here's Truman's words. "I casually mentioned to Stalin that we had a new weapon of unusual destructive force. The Russian premier showed no special interest. All he said was that he was glad to hear it and hoped we would make, quote, good use of it against the Japanese." The fact is that Stalin maintained his composure there, but went back among his own delegation, and here is the way Marshal Zhukov remembers what Stalin said when he got back among the Russian delegates. "On returning to his quarters after this meeting, Stalin, in my presence, told Molotov about his conversation with Truman. The latter reacted immediately. Well, let them use it then. We'll have to talk it over with Kurchatov and get him to speed our own research up." I realized that they were talking about research on the atomic bomb. And now here's this man who's telling this story, his comments about that exchange. "Very few turning points in history can be specified precisely. When Rome began to decline, when it can be said to have fallen, when the Renaissance began, or even exactly what the Renaissance was, all these questions become murky as they shade off into questions of preconditions. But whether Stalin knew exactly what Truman was talking about that evening, or whether he only came to realize it later on, here is one turning point in history that can be dated with extraordinary precision. The 20th century's nuclear arms race began at the Centennial Palace at 7:30 p.m. on July 24, 1945. Because you notice the Russian reaction is immediately, well, we've got to speed up and catch up with them so that we'll achieve a kind of parity in their own possession of this weapon. Now, July 25th comes, and another complicated development happens, not unlike the one that happened on July 12th, because then another cable is intercepted by American intelligence that has passed between the Japanese and the Russians. The Russians still not in the war, the Japanese trying to use them as neutral offices to end the war by advocating their position to the British and the Americans. I'd now like to read you from that cable.
Did they pass on those telegrams?
Directly to Truman and Burns, yes. So they had
the Russians, the Americans know that?
No. There was mutual suspicion and secrecy on both sides. So it was the Russians didn't pass it on to the Americans because from their standpoint, they were interested in having the war continue long enough so that they could get in. The Americans, in the meantime, want to end it soon enough to keep Russia out. So when they intercept the cables, they neither tell the Russians that they know about this, nor tell the Japanese that they know. Okay? So it's a real horribly tragic cloak and dagger game going on. And here now is a selection from this cable. "The Japanese tell the Russians to speak to the British and the Americans at the earliest possible opportunity and plead with them for terms of surrender short of unconditional surrender." Okay? And then here is how they continue. "We are willing to surrender on those terms based on the Atlantic Charter. Also, it is necessary to have the British and Americans understand that we are trying to end hostilities by asking for very reasonable terms in order to secure and maintain our nation's existence and honor. And finally, should United States and Great Britain remain insistent on formality, there is no solution to this situation other than for us to hold out until complete collapse, because it is this one point, the recognition of our emperor alone." That was on July 25th. On that day, President Truman orders the use of the two atomic bombs against Japan as early after August 3rd as weather permits. The next day, the Americans, the British, and the Chinese issue the Potsdam Proclamation, which consists of many clauses. I want now to read you the last clause of that proclamation. "We call upon the government of Japan to proclaim now the unconditional surrender of all the Japanese armed forces and to provide proper and adequate assurances of their good faith in such action. The alternative for Japan is prompt and utter destruction. In other words, they basically call for unconditional surrender, and they know by virtue of the cable that's intercepted that that's the one terms that the Japanese will still fight until their own utter destruction. By this time now, the timing, whether it's the 5th or the 6th or the 7th, is contingent upon such things as weather conditions. The bombs are delivered to an island in the Marianas, Tinian, and there they are loaded onto a B-29, and on August 6th, at 8:15, the first atomic bomb is dropped on the city of Hiroshima.
Mark, any indication why both were ordered at the same time, not in Sarada?
The only answer to that, frankly, is that at that time, those were the weapons we had developed. That is to say, there weren't any more, and there weren't any fewer. There were two. And so the order was, use them both. Okay? In other words, there weren't two separate orders. There was mechanisms for countermanding the order for the second one should the first one prove decisive. But as you see, there are only really 3 days difference. Okay. So on August 6th, the bomb is dropped. Truman learns of this on board ship on the way now back from Potsdam, because the conference has ended August 2nd. When he gets the cable on board ship, he says, this is surely the greatest thing in history. Those are his first words.
So the reason they didn't drop it before the 3rd was that the Potsdam agreement, they didn't end that until the 2nd. It seems strange to me that he makes the decision on the 25th and they wait so long to drop it. I always thought more that you made a decision and things happened almost the next day.
Yeah, but the weather was bad.
That's right. The weather, there were all kinds of, here we're tied up with basic logistics. In other words, the military has told Truman that they can't have the bombs ready to drop before August 3rd. So the order reads, drop the bombs on or about August 3rd or as soon as possible afterwards, weather permitting. So really the 6th is sort of a function of weather and logistics. And when they could have...
It had nothing to do with the ending of the conference. It was just as soon as they could be ready.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Were the location, the cities decided by Truman? Or
those were decided by the military. And in fact, Nagasaki was a secondary target. In fact, Nagasaki was not the primary target for the second bomb because of weather conditions. Another Japanese city, I think Kyoto, but I could be mistaken.
Why did the weather matter so much?
It had to do with basically airplane flight and navigational and precision in dropping it and so on, those kinds of things.
Did you repeat what Truman said?
He said, this is the greatest thing in history, when he got the cable that announced the dropping of the Hiroshima bomb. I think there's another quote I can read you that he said shortly thereafterwards when he burst into the officer's quarters. He said, keep your seats, gentlemen. We have just dropped a bomb on Japan which has more power than 20,000 tons of TNT. It was an overwhelming success. We won the gamble. Now something happens on August 9th, which I would like very much to read to you. Because on August 9th, there's a meeting of the Japanese cabinet. And the cabinet is being addressed by a high Japanese official. And he says the following thing to that cabinet. It's Prime Minister Suzuki. He's addressing the cabinet. He says, under the present circumstances, I have concluded that our only alternative is to accept the Potsdam Proclamation and terminate the war at once. I would like to hear your opinions on this. This is the morning of August 9th. 1 minute later, the bomb is dropped on Nagasaki. 2 hours before that, the Japanese have received the cable from Moscow, which announces the Russian declaration of war against the Japanese. Moscow declares war on the 8th. Japan gets the announcement on the 9th, has the cabinet meeting. One minute literally after that cabinet meeting, Nagasaki bomb is dropped. The Japanese surrender on the 10th. The surrender is announced on the 14th and formalized on September 2nd. The story ends there. I have tried to give it to you in a kind of straightforward way to let you draw your own conclusions about why we dropped the bomb. I'll share with you my own. I think that the awesome task that President Truman faced, all at the same time, ought not to be underestimated. I think, too, that he went to his grave believing that he dropped the bomb to save American lives, to save millions of American lives, as he said. As a matter of fact, the number of American lives lost in World War II was about 300,000, compared to, for instance, in Russia, 18 million. In China, 25 million. And one could go on down and list statistics. So that the earliest that the Americans would have incurred those kinds of losses would have been November 1st with the land invasion. And I gave you the statistics on what just one firebombing as early as March in Tokyo had done to that city. 80,000 dead, 1 million refugees, 25% of the city destroyed. So I've given you the Joint Chiefs of Staff opinion, I've given you the scientist's petition, and I hope I've given you at least some sober recognition that if one wants finally to come to some full sense of this explanation, one has to consider the diplomatic aspects of it, particularly what was going on in Secretary of State Burns' mind, and I guess my own tentative conclusion, apart from thinking that this is a ghastly tragedy, is that the historian who wrote the book called The Atomic Diplomacy was right, namely that the people who died at Hiroshima and Nagasaki were not the last casualties of World War II, but were in fact the first casualties of the Cold War. Those conclusions are tentative, but I think all conclusions based on interpretations of historical materials are. But I think that another thing that considering this has led me to realize, a gentleman last night said to me, as I did, it's a very deep reference to this, but don't you realize that this was during a terrible war and the terrible pressures upon Truman and so on, and you're sitting here now with 2020 hindsight. What I would like to respond now is that's in a way just the point. The terrible pressures of war forced human beings into all kinds of decisions, whether they are come from liberal democracies or totalitarian governments or whatever. War is such a terrible thing that when terrible weapons of destruction are invented, they almost create their own necessity for use. And the fact that staggers me is that Truman never considered not using these bombs because there was just a kind of natural momentum to the whole historical situation which called for whatever means were necessary to bring an end to this war. I mean, it had been going on, as a matter of fact, for years, for Americans for 4 years, for other countries longer. It's just a lesson in the fact that efforts to control history through might are fraught with all kinds of horrible peril. That is, not just the staggering loss in life, but I believe that this particular story is right. The arms race began, the nuclear arms race began on July 24th at 7:30 p.m. in Potsdam, when the Americans allegedly told Stalin about the development of atomic weapons, the trust in that alliance already having eroded tremendously, the desire to keep them out of the Eastern theater, the bomb being tied up with diplomacy, and Stalin immediately responded to it, and he certainly was no angel, and I don't know anybody would think I suggested that. But he immediately responded, tell our boys to speed up research and development of nuclear weapons. There's one consequence. The Soviet-American Cold War started before the Second World War ended, partly as a result of this, partly as a result of lots of other things. Those are some of my tentative reflections, but yeah.
I remember talking about the big time bombs, and there was an awful hue and cry over them using them because, like you said, they were killing innocent people. Mm-hmm. And if I remember correctly, the American people didn't think this was very fair. They didn't mind the napalm being used by military, but to be going and dropping it in on innocent people and burning them out put an awful lot of pressure, if I remember on Truman. And the second thing I can remember, how true all this is, I don't know. It's not fact that I know. I also heard, kind of like rumors, that Stalin, when he took over Germany, took most of the German scientists and so forth, physicists, that were working on this type of rocket research, stuff like that, and took them back to Germany and forced them to work.
He forced them, in fact, did force some of the German scientists to work on that, and in fact, in numbers,
I know this was not brought out in your presentation, because I think this is probably a little bit that influenced the fact that the movie, you have to go up to Stalin, well, we've got one, we just tested it, it works all right. Just kind of put a little thorn in this kind of unfortunately, it's backfired instead of
Well, I think you wanted to put more than a thorn in the side. Jim Burns once said that he basically could shoot from his upper top because he had a atomic weapon. And what he meant by that, basically, not only could he make the Soviets more tractable in Eastern Europe, but also felt this way too. But that he could also, as I said, now keep them out of the Pacific. And so I think that's right. In fact, I think that's one of the prime motives for being so delighted that the test worked in the 16th. And then waiting 8 days while the British and Americans had a chance to kind of consult about the implications of this nuclear supremacy and play the Trump part as effectively as it could be played. Yes.
How informed was Truman about the potential of what nuclear weapons could do?
That's a very difficult question to answer. Certainly, we got no details of the facts in the first paper we got on the 16th. He was told, because in the quote I read, when he learned about Hiroshima, he's exactly right, 20,000 times of TNT. When he goes in and tells the officers, Jack Lovey just dropped the bomb, he tells them that it's 20,000 times of TNT. Meantime, he arrives back in Washington, and aerial photographs are sent to him, showing the results of the rocket before the Nagasaki bomb is dropped. Okay? It's considerable that you're asking, well, could he have pictured in his own mind the awesome destructive force of this weapon? I think probably not before Hiroshima, but certainly before Nagasaki. Whether or not, once he saw the photograph, if he had wanted to, he could have countermanded that order. I don't know. But that is good. You want to get a time on the Nagasaki order. As a matter of fact, the thing that's so tragic, so grotesque is tragic in a way, because weather again affected the Nagasaki thing. In fact, the initial plan was dropped there on the left. By this time, probably the Japanese would have surrendered. I mean, I read that quote from the cabinet meeting 1 minute before Nagasaki. But because meteorologists saw a front coming in or whatever, and the 11th would be bad, they set up that particular bomb and dropped it on the map.
I think the
American
people
were killed in the 2,000. Around, estimates vary, but around 100,000. So the people were worried about the military being the American people. So the American people, as that man said, were aware of the firebombing, but the American people had absolutely no access in advance to the whole atomic weapons. That is, that's what I say, was an extraordinarily well-packed secret. So they would have had no input to that policy whatsoever. And it's another fact that the firebombing of Tokyo and other Japanese cities killed many more people than the two atomic bombs combined.
How much the military has Truman to justify setting on a mainland, working on that? I mean, it's not enough
easy. As a matter of fact, one Admiral Leahy, who was the military advisor to Truman, said in his diary that he thought, as a matter of fact, the reason he used those weapons is because he'd always spent so much money on them, and they were going to Now, he said that in a kind of glib way, and he said it in the context of not being able to figure out any other reason. Because he left the young chief of staff neither. See, most people think, well, like last night I quoted in the U.S. American Strategic Bombing Survey, which was admittedly made after the war was over. And there are first conclusion was the town would have surrendered by August 15th, even if Russia hadn't entered the war, even if we hadn't used nuclear weapons, and even if no invasion of Japan had been planned or contemplated. And the response to that sometimes is, with that contract. But this Joint Chiefs of Staff meeting, which I summarized, Eisenhower, totally unnecessary, won't say it anyway. And I read Marshall's suggestion of a warning. And I read King's suggestion that a naval blockade would handle it. And I could read other military reports from Marshall, which is just chilling on the 28th, describing the Japanese. Basically, there was total freedom of the seas and total freedom of the air. There simply was no resistance to the bombing. The only resistance to Japanese at this point were mustering, where the kamikaze flights against some airplanes shipping, and that did kill American men, but nowhere near the thousands or several thousands of American lives that were allegedly, you know, saved by Japanese officials.
One thing I've been reading some time ago is that Eisenhower said to wear the military industrial complex, and now that you presented it here, it looks as though it's not the military so much as a concern in this scenario, but it's the political.
And this particular case, I think that's absolutely correct. Yeah. As a matter of fact, Eisenhower is doing the president thing, and he's by historians being, I think, elevated steadily year by year, precisely because as a general, he understood war and his scenery differently. And basically knew what he said, and he's the one who comes out with the hardest statement right in that staff meeting, these weapons simply oughtn't to be used. And you're right, he did make the military industrial contract speech. It was written for him by someone else, and some, like all speeches are, and some people think that you haven't been fully aware of those implications. I don't really buy that. I think that that's why Eisenhower was as a person who understood war in a way that people who hadn't seen it the way he had do not.
Well, I was just going to say, too, well, these men, when they were speaking about this, had no idea what this thing would do. I mean, up to them, it was like you read in your auditory, this gentleman who saw the bomber stood outside of his hut in World War I, and it made a hole about the size of that fireplace there. To him, that was awesome. And yet, this is some of the stuff that we dropped during World War II on Germany. Some of these guys were too Germany, and seeing the devastation, or even in England, 500,000 pound, 2,000 pound bombs were nothing. And the risk was big. And nobody had any idea what 10,000 pounds of TNT would do, let alone 20,000 pounds. And I think it was probably was speaking somewhat too, probably of a little ignorant, not knowing exactly what would happen. They were probably thinking there was a little explosion there, and that would be it. Because when they went after these two targets, these were the main manufacturing areas of that country. And the idea was they could knock those areas out and make them totally unopposite again, so they couldn't be rebuilt fast enough, and thereby saving a lot of time and a lot of effort.